let's rock Joe Cocker with Respect Yourself on Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. I'm host Sheldon Brown with technician Declan Curran, and Take It From Us is brought to you and funded by Framework Trust. Now, experts are saying that we're obsessed with being happy, and it's actually making us miserable. And this article came from the Facebook page of our guest that we're going to talk to a little bit later. But it does say that we're obsessed with being happy, but that is making us miserable. We lap up the latest books, podcasts, apps from the billion-dollar wellness industry, share images of our best filtered selves on social media, and organise our lives around the goal of bliss. But this preoccupation with being happy is making us miserable, experts warn. So there's a journalist and author, Jill Stark, whose new book, Happy Never After, explores modern society's fairy tale syndrome, and she says people have come to believe that sadness is abnormal and something to fear. So we airbrush, she says, out the messy parts of our lives and only show the world the glossy, curated highlights real to people. It can make you feel abnormal and like an outsider if you're not happy. And so it says really that the more important importance placed on being happy, the unhappier and more depressed people become. Well, that's just a thought to leave you with at the start of Take It From Us today. 6 weeks ago, we interviewed Denise Calto, a consumer with 40 years' experience of mental health services. She said at the end of that last interview 6 weeks ago that her exposure to mental health services hadn't all been doom and gloom. And I quote her in an email, "I've had some extremely good service and some appalling service as well. Because I've had such a range of different services over 40 years, I have some insight into what works and what definitely doesn't." And I quote again, "I can talk about being suicidal in the last couple of years and what kept me alive. Some things pushed me closer to the edge, while some things have kept me alive." So let's welcome Denise again to Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, and ask her about this sort of these contrasting experiences of mental health services. So, Denise, if you could tell listeners about what you describe as extremely good services.
Yeah, well, interesting your little taste bite at the beginning there about happiness, you know, our search for happiness making us miserable. Part of a really good service for me was when, as a consumer group, we got to explore this concept of happiness and how it affected us. Because one of the things that we realised was that that this concept of happiness, when you're a person who feels, you know, chronically suicidal and all this sort of stuff, that it can be like, you know, I don't want to. This is ridiculous. Don't tell me to be happy if I'm, you know, depressed or miserable all the time. But actually, part of our searching through those concepts was extremely valuable. And maybe we'll come back and talk about that a little bit later. Some of the other things, services that have been incredibly valuable and helpful to me was when I was a person who... I have bipolar and autistic spectrum disorder, although I've only been diagnosed with autistic spectrum disorder in the last year. But I've been under mental health services from about the age of 5, and I'm 52 now, so I've had a long contact both in, you know, in child and youth services as well as in my teens, being in institutions like King Seat and Tokanui, being in... the public health system, where I've been in acute services and subacute services, and I've been in Ashburn Clinic. It was Ashburn Hall then, and again, I went to Ashburn Clinic briefly last year as well. And so I've also been in community services and more recently in peer support services, and some here in Waitemata that have been... alternative acute services, which are have a peer support component and a clinical component. So when the first thing that was really important to me was when I was 26, I went to Ashburn Hall, and that's a therapeutic community.
In Dunedin, yep.
And I was funded at the time by the public hospital because the court ordered them to fund me to go down there. And what was very useful was that I had, in quite a big number of years over my teen years, I was electively mute. So I could communicate, but I didn't, especially in public. And I had no ability to recognise my feelings or certainly not communicate them. And the thing that was the breakthrough for me was art therapy. Like, when I first started doing art therapy was the very beginning of me suddenly feeling like I made a connection with people in the world, that people started to, relate to what I was... Well, I could communicate for the first time by using that process.
So did they start to see what art you were producing and started to take notice of it and appreciate it and comment positively about it?
No, art therapy is quite different from that, because you're talking about, like, creative expression, like art as a form of just, you know, expressing yourself, whereas art therapy is actually a particular type of therapy. And what they do is, you normally would have, say, a theme for the day or a question, and so you and then you'd get time to just write it down, and there's meaning. It's a little bit like tapping into your subconscious mind, the way you would with a dream or something like that, is that the colours you use and what you draw and so forth, you don't worry at all about what you put down or how you put it down or anything like that. You just respond like almost just in the moment.
And then you talk about it at the end. Oh, right, yes.
So you have a therapist there, and then you talk about, like, and people from the group that you're with normally actually will comment on things, so you actually learn about things that you're not conscious of through that process.
So how was it you commenting on what you had put down in front of you? If you were electively mute, as you describe it, did this bring out your ability to express yourself?
Yeah, well, I think that I did start to talk around that stage at times, and the art was a really good way, because when you've actually got drawn a picture, you can talk to the picture. So it's actually a simpler process than having to think about what you're going to say.
And did you feel proud, though, of what you had created and was showing the rest of the class? Did you have a pride in it, or were you very shy about
that? You'd probably be very horrified, but several years later, I did an exhibition, because I went to Teachers College, and afterwards, after I'd been in hospital and that, and one of the assignments we had to do was around a community event, and I did an exhibition that had my art therapy and my creative expression, because my art was like a visual diary of my recovery. I've still got it all, actually. It's quite interesting. My very first pictures in art therapy were so angry. They were all black and red, actually. The colours were all black and red. They were stick figures. They had things like, I want to kill you, and I'm going to kill myself, and I hate everything. And it was really, this was the sort of thing. And prison cells and all sorts of really dark, sad things. And then as I got, as my recovery took place, my artistic expression became more full. And I started doing life drawing, and so actually putting it around the wall, you could see how it represented the changes inside of me, because I became more of a whole person.
So your ability to talk Did that advance? Did that emerge through this process?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
And how?
And
how,
also the therapeutic community, because a lot of what they do down there is based on groups and group work. So, I was considered to have no empathy or anything like that. So, having the other people in the groups feeding back to me how what I did affected them was a very big learning for me, to suddenly realise that, oh, what I do and what I say has an impact on other people.
Right.
So there's all sorts of things. But in that therapeutic community, they also had like music therapy and psychodrama, and they had a movie group where, like, you'd show a movie and people would talk. So there was all these types, forms of therapies, and everybody's different. So how, you know, what would work for one person wouldn't work, but usually people had one of the therapy types that they had down there. It would be really good for them, you know, and they'd really connect to it. Like if you were a person that was into music, being able to choose a song that expresses something that you feel is a way of communicating what's going on for you that words don't.
I was just going to quickly jump in if I can and say, I guess it's true then when they say that a picture paints 1,000 words. But did you find putting things on paper actually helps get it out of the system?
It did, yeah, very much. I can't really describe what a relief it was for me. I remember going, because we had access to the art room, and after I started doing art therapy, I remember going down to the art room in my own time and just drawing. And it was just tears of it was actually literally tears that I was drawing, and it was me expressing my relief at suddenly being able to connect with people in a way I hadn't before.
Have you ever experienced the benefits of that art therapy and art expression in other acute units or in other hospitals that you've been in?
No, but I have just started an art therapy group that's being offered up here through Mind and Body.
Oh.
Rodney Mental Health Team is actually funding me to do it.
Wow.
Because if you get a prescription or a fund for them, you can actually do it for nothing. And so I just started that 3 weeks ago because I've had such a difficult time in the last couple of years, and that's been because I'd been well for a long period of time, and then, as you know, I got unwell in the last couple of years. So I thought this might be a way, because I've been feeling a lot of grief and a lot of anger, and so I thought, well, maybe I'll try it again.
How can people access that? Is that open? We could promote it on the show here?
Yeah, well, I know it's through Body and Mind.
Mind and Body, yeah.
Mind and Body, sorry, yeah. And, so contact them and they'll probably give you some info.
Okay, so that's...
I was just going to say, I think that's quite good because it's giving you time out from the day. Like, for me, the equivalent would be sit out on the deck, music, book, cup of tea type thing. I think that's important to be able to just break away from all the expectations and pressures that we get in our daily life.
Yeah.
Well, and I think one of the great things is that we do this with a group, or
yes,
we do this with other people, and we can see other people's creativity, their expression. We can also have appreciation of what we're doing.
Because you have to be really clear that art therapy is not about art, it's about communication. And there is no pressure to draw or to be able to draw or to have any artistic, skills or abilities, because that would actually limit your ability to participate in the process. So you just go with what you can. And
so there's a distinction between art therapy and sort of just going and drawing, and the creativity that Toy or Alive Arts offers people in a group setting.
Yeah.
But that also can be very therapeutic, can't it?
It is, and I think that the art therapy is something that people that tend to be artistic might be drawn towards. But, it's definitely not a requirement.
Well, I've been in a situation where I didn't think I had any artistic ability at all, and I did get involved in beadwork, and that led on to bone carving at Framework, and as a result of being in the bone carving school and working with the Conrad Solomon, who was the tutor there. We used to go to the Devonport Art Place, Community Art Centre, and sell some of the things that we were doing. And, you know, I think that was all part of recovery.
It is, yeah. In fact, I'll tell you a little bit of a story of when, like, when I was 16, I was in Kingsheath Hospital, which is one of the old institutions out in South Auckland. And it was very unusual, really, to have people my age in the hospitals in those
days. Age were you then?
I was 16, yeah. And so I was there for 6 months that time, and my behaviour and, you know, how I was very challenging for them, because I was, you know, constantly trying to kill myself, jumping out top floor windows and smashing all my bones and running out in front of trucks, and I had no impulse control and no self-awareness. I had no empathy, and you know, I was very very difficult to take care of and stuff like that. And one of the things that there was a breakthrough in a way of how, when I suddenly changed when I was there, that, and it became more manageable, is and what it was that I started, they found that when I went down, they have a big art room and a big massive craft room, when I was down there I was just like an ordinary person. I was like that when I was a kid at school, like my behaviours were incredibly out of control and challenging, and yet when there was something that I was interested in, that I would be very engrossed in it and enjoy it. And so they started taking me down to the art room every day when I was at Kingsheath, and that just turned everything around for me. And in fact, instead of like being on the ward most of the time with the nurses, the OT took me under her wing. And not only did I go down and I'd do stuff myself in the art and the craft room, but I actually started helping her with, like, because there was geriatric wards in Kingsheath Hospital, and I started helping her with the oldies and that, helping them do their crafts. And it gave me a sense of pride and worth.
A purpose.
And my whole behaviour in the hospital changed, because suddenly I had a place in there, and I developed this relationship, which wasn't very easy for me to develop relationships with people, with the OT. And so,
how much of thinking of other people rather than thinking of yourself? I mean, often we get a bit self-obsessed, don't we?
Yeah.
Was that a factor in the benefits of that?
It was, and that, to me, that thing there is actually quite a key to being able to help people in recovery, is that they can do things where they, because it's important for me to feel like I'm of value, you know, that I'm of value, that I'm not just a big waste of space, and that I'm not a big drain on society, that I'm contributing in some way. It makes me feel like, you know, in terms of my self-esteem, that...
Well, it sounds as though what you're doing with mind and body, and I'd like to come back to that. Let's take a music break, and thank you, Denise, for being so candid and honest about those parts of your history. What have we got?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's as we've said before in the past, by giving, you actually receive a lot back, because you know you're helping someone else, and it takes you away from that clinical environment. What have we got today? Well, REM. No prizes if you can guess who they are. Rapid Eye Movement. The song is Everybody Hurts. I think everyone will know it. Going back quite a way, I think, from memory. Want to get some volume to it?
Yeah.
Well, this is Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us on Planet FM 104.6, and I'm Sheldon Brown with Declan Curran, and we're talking today to consumer Denise Calto about, initially her good experiencings, but they are contrasting experiences, and Denise has been telling us about the value of art therapy and creativity at Ashburn, what was called Ashburn Hall at that time. You were transferred, Denise, from Ashburn to Northland and to Whangarei.
Well, it went back to Ashburn last year because I was in my 20s when I first went to Ashburn Hall. But I went to Ashburn Clinic, transferred from Northland Hospital last year, and I spent 6 months there, and it was quite different, actually. I didn't find it as helpful. They sort of seemed to be in a bit of crisis, and maybe funds were a bit difficult for them, and some of the really good therapies that I found there in the earlier years were not being run in the same way, and so it just sort of felt like everybody was a little bit traumatised, and I still actually trust, like, the trust is a very important thing for me, that I still actually trust Ashburn, and I would go back there if I had the opportunity, But I'd have to be very careful, because I think that there's no point in being in a place that's not helpful, you know.
Well, we have expectations, don't we? If we've had a good positive experience there and you go back and it's changed dramatically and expectations aren't met. Are you talking about your latest...
Yes, so my latest admission last year, but then I was transferred back to Northland Health, to Whangarei Hospital, to the inpatient unit and then the subacute unit, and I had very, very difficult experiences there. In fact, they've been life-changing for me, really, and incredibly traumatising and horrendous.
So life-changing in a negative way, not a positive way.
Yeah, and... I felt gutted, actually, after all the work that we've done over the years in the consumer movement and trying to get services better and, you know, changed. And I was actually horrified at how people's experience was, because I spoke to a few people in my experience there, and I ended up running away. I wasn't illegally running away, but I came back down. And I stayed with my dad. But one of the good things that occurred was that I came to a place, somebody that I knew in Whangarei. She was a manager at Whangarei, and she rung me because she was really worried, because I was very suicidal, and she wanted to try her best to help me. And she organised for somebody from Connect, an organisation down here, to come and get me and take me to a place called Piri Pono. Now, they call that an alternative acute service. So there's, so they have a clinical team, a small clinical team, and they have it's run by peer support workers. And so there's only a few people, maybe 10 at the most, people there at the time. And you're only allowed to stay there for like 10 days.
Like a respite?
It's not a respite, because it is an acute service, and but it's I found that really good, very helpful, and they just left me alone, and I got some peace and some rest, and I felt valued and respected there, which I didn't at Northland at all.
So was this your first experience with peer support?
This was my first experience with peer support. And then since then, I've also used a service called Koromiko, which is it Emerge or...?
It's Equip, I think.
Equip, yes, yeah, I can't remember which one.
I was taken to Koromiko, and we were going to do a broadcast about Koromiko. I took a look at this. I was taken there by the CEO of Equip, and I said, well, when can I book in?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's probably the most amazing place I've actually been. Like, I found it peaceful and helpful and restful. That is a respite place, and you can stay there, like, 10 days or 14 days.
Well, I think they've got spa baths associated with the bedrooms, you know, like...
Oh, I didn't come across that. There might be one... There's one really big room, so maybe it's in there, but it didn't have that. It's a nice... the house is nice, and the food is lovely, and the staff were lovely.
Well, it's got $5 million views across the Hauraki Gulf.
I'm in.
and I just found... But the thing about it is I felt safe there. Hmm. And to me, like, my experience over the years has been actually what the place looks like does not matter at all. It could be a dive if you feel safe and respected. Then, you know, that's the most important thing. And that's where I think that over all the changes, over all the years for the changes, that's what hasn't changed. Is in the public system, like, I feel frightened. And
where does that fear come from? From being locked in and having to ask for permission to leave and that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, the very, very first time when I was 16, when I went to Kingsead, I was told that if I went in voluntary, that would be a good thing, and I could go out and check it up for a few days, and if I didn't like it, I could leave. And then when I said, no, I don't like it, I want to leave, and they committed me. So straight away, my trust was never that great. And there was always, but you know, things did change over the years. But I found that there's always that coercive component to it. You know, you either stay in subacute and as a voluntary patient, or we'll commit you. It's not really, you're not really a voluntary patient if you've got that hanging over your head. And
I wonder how much stress that actually places on people as well. It's all very well to commit somebody in, but then when you're going through that acute treatment, suddenly thinking, well, when am I going to get out? That must surely have an impact combined with what you've been committed for in the first place.
I probably couldn't even tell you the number of reasons why I don't feel safe there. There was just so many little reasons, like that I was having angina, and they not only did they not give me my angina spray when I asked for it, but a nurse got into an argument saying, you're not even prescribed it. And I said, yes, I am. And they said, no, you're not. And I said, yes, I am, because I had my prescription in my bag. But stupid little things. There's so many stupid, inconsistent things that just make you feel unsafe.
But not only do they make you feel unsafe, they disempower one as well. And that seems to be part of the program in these acute units, that it's all about disempowering. I mean, some people who don't remember your name and deliberately don't remember your name.
Well, I first got to the acute unit in Whangarei, I didn't actually get fed for the first three meals because I'm gluten intolerant. And, nobody actually told me where I could get breakfast or anything, but there's nothing. And part of the stress that I was experiencing, even the subacute unit, was the complexities of them trying to accommodate somebody with gluten intolerance made it incredibly difficult in so many ways. And you feel like you're a nuisance anyway.
Starting off on the back foot, aren't you, before you even get in there, sort of thing. If they're not going to take that care there, that has huge ramifications for the care for what you're in there for.
Yeah, and like when you talk about Koromiko, right, they just go out of their road. Like, their staff does all the cooking in that, but they make sure that everybody's diet, whether you're vegan, and it seems like a silly little thing, but it makes you feel valued.
Yeah. Well, they also have an art room.
They do have an art room.
Did you avail yourself of that?
Yep.
Yeah, no, well, I was showing around there and I was, well, I'd never seen anything in mental health quite like Koromiko.
I would love to live in a place like that.
So here's a question. Why can we not take that model and take people from there around the country to other organisations and say, this is how it's done, this is what works, this is what's needed for the people that are in these wards? Because you're trying to get yourself better to get out.
Yeah.
How are you going to do that if you're not looked after and respected?
Yeah, because there's this real fear that people are going to become dependent and, I always hear this thing about, you know, we don't want to do it for you, we want to do it with you or something, you know, because we want you to... They push and push and push. But sometimes people have just got to accept, like, especially somebody like me with bipolar and autism, there's some things that I'm just never going to be able to do because it's so stressful that actually... I'd rather be dead than have to be dealing with these things.
I had a friend at Waiatarau, which is the mental health unit associated with Waitakere Hospital, and I went to see her. She was prevented from going for a walk with me on the Thursday, and yet the next day they allowed her...
To go home, probably.
To go home to my place.
The inconsistencies are crazy.
So I wasn't a fit person to take her out for a walk, or to go for a walk with her, but the very next day, 24 hours later, she was able to stay at my house overnight.
Well, those inconsistencies make a mockery of things. And I mean, I have to say, even though Petey Pono was really, really good, like there was one example of something that they did that I thought was one of these inconsistencies, and that is my medications were monitored because I was so suicidal over the period of time I was there. And then the day I left... I was only there 10 days, and then on the day I left, all of my medications that were there were given to me, so there was more than lethal doses of medications that I walked out the door with.
Which makes a laugh of this whole, we'll give you a script and then come back for the two repeats, really, doesn't it?
Well, they do that. There's no doubt about
well,
that.
Well, when I was, I came from Ashburn Clinic, and I was doing my own medications there. Yeah. They have a locked drawers up there, so they should know. There's no consistency, like going from a place where I'm doing my own medications. You know, I get it once a week, put it in the locked drawer and deal with it myself, and then they'll suddenly say, oh no, you're suicidal, so you can't have these medications, and then 10 days later giving me a lethal dose to walk out the door with. Mm-hmm. It's like there's no rhyme or reason, and it does make a mockery of it.
Let's take another music break, and thanks again to our guest Anise Kalto for her frank observations of the inconsistencies of our acute mental health units. I think we're going to...
No, we're not going to her till later.
I'm not
saving the best for last, kind of. I've got an Aretha Franklin for you later, but I just wanted to pop in there that on the weekend I went to one of two special screenings for a movie called Andy Irons, Kisses from God, and like myself, he had a bipolar condition. He was a top surfer on and off, competing with the likes of Mick Fanning, Kelly Slater, that sort of thing, and unfortunately the pressure of that group got as such that they got into the whole drug aspects, and then they got into that oxycillin or whatever it was, and he was actually trying to come down from that on his way back from a championship in Puerto Rico. Called his wife and said, I can't do this flight, I've got to sleep all day, and they found him deceased in his hotel room because he was trying to come off this stuff. Quite a sad movie actually, but anyway, I just thought I'd share that with you. Now,
it's
Andy Irons, Kisses from God. It was only on, I saw it at Albany at the event cinemas, and it was only doing a 4 o'clock Saturday and Sunday. So it was really good. As you know, I want to try and get a variety of music, so you young ones out there, get your headphones on, because here comes a song for you from Jake Rees, and it's called Find You, and you're listening to 104.6 Planet FM. We are Mental Health Radio, broadcasting every Tuesday at 12:30.
When I'm looking for colors, when I'm stuck in a world of gray, there's a part of me pointing to you like a compass. Every inch of your body is like it's penciled into my brain, and I carry you around like you fit in my pocket. And nothing or nothing they do could keep me away from you. Yeah, nothing or nothing they do could keep me away from you. 'Cause I see you shining through. No, I don't get lost, and it's all because I know that I'll find you. Yeah, when skies get dark, you're my northern star. And I know. I know that I'm
with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And I must congratulate Declan on just how smooth an operator he is these days with his Spotify music and bringing that sting in about Take It From Us.
Oh, shucks.
Oh, shucks, he says. Well, we're talking to our guest today, Denise Kelto, not Dennis Sheldon, Denise Kelto. And Denise wants to talk about the feelings of suicide that she's had over the last few years, and what's kept you alive, Denise, over that time.
Yeah, I guess this is, you know, like, people are talking about suicide a lot more, and it's you know, it's the message that's getting out there is that it's not an uncommon feeling. It's not not something a lot of people have the feeling and thought at times, especially at difficult times in their lives. It's not common to act on it, and this is where we want to try and stop people from acting on it. And I'm in this really interesting situation, is that in the last couple of years, even though for many years I was involved in suicide prevention and trying to help bring a bit of light to what happens around this sort of stuff, I actually felt got to a place of really wanting to take my life in the last couple of years, and it's been very, very difficult for me to get out of. And there's something that happened for me that's probably been the one thing that kept me alive, and I wanted to share it because I thought it might help other people that have got people around them that are going through this. And my family were amazing this time, like when I became unwell, because we had a very fractured family, and there was a lot of you know, separation and a lot of dysfunction in our family when we were younger. So for all of us to be coming, my family really came in around me in the last 2 years in a way that I've never really experienced before. I think they knew that this time round I had nothing left in me to try and pull myself out of the position that I was in.
You mean you had nothing really in the tank?
Nothing in the tank. Over the years, every time I got to that stage, it got worse and worse. And this time, there just really was nothing in it. And I was quite surprised that my family came in around me in a way that was unexpected and incredibly special, and it kept me alive. And my
can you describe what your family did particularly? I mean, when you say they came in around you.
Well, my father, for one thing that happened when I was in Northland, was because I ended up getting in an incident with a nurse, and so that ended up in court. So my family and support services have supported me to deal with that situation. Which I probably wouldn't have been able to deal with on my own. And so they didn't judge me, and they just came in around and helped me. They attended every court case. They've helped me financially. I'm staying at my father's house, and they've helped me by going up to my place up north and keeping an eye on things at times. And you know, practical. It's been hard because because the help has needed to be gone on for the last couple of years. That's because it's been so long to get supports in place for me to become independent again. So it's really pushed them to the max, especially in the last year or so, to stick in there with me. But they have. But the thing that, when I was really at a point where I just wanted to end my life, and there was nothing else that I wanted to do. My sister said to me, because at first she was trying to be a little bit, like, I guess, politically correct and say, you know, I don't want to impose my will on you, and I want you to do what you know, I want you to be able to do what you want. But she just realised, she sort of started saying that, and then she said, no, I can't make this okay for you. It's not okay for me that you kill yourself. And she said, I could live without you, but I don't want to. I want you in my life, and you're really, really important to me. And she rung me every day. Every day she rang me. And one of the things that she started to do was say, I love you. We're not very affectionate. We've never really been a sort of demonstrative or affectionate family. And like my dad and my sister and that, they'd hug me. And something that I've not always been that comfortable with, but it made a difference. And her saying, ringing me and saying, I love you, I want you in my life, I don't want to live without you, and you're my best friend, and these sorts of things. You wouldn't think that it would make a difference, but it did.
Mm. How much of a difference did it make to you?
Well, it kept me alive. And, you know, there's part of me that says it was frickin' annoying because I wanted out. And it was almost, but it stopped me from easily getting out.
So, I mean, and how you're still alive today, you're doing a radio broadcast, you've driven down from somewhere up north, that all reflects a degree of independence, of recovery. Are you grateful that...
No, I'm not.
You're not?
I know. I think other consumers that would be in the same position as me would understand why I'd say that, because I still struggle daily to stay alive.
Right.
You know?
But earlier in this interview, you were telling us about this art initiative that you're going to set up or are setting up with Mind and Body. I'd like to know exactly where that is. Where are you going to base that?
Oh, no, I'm not setting it up. I'm actually doing the art therapy myself. I'm taking part as a participant, and so they're running it, and I'm just taking part in it, yeah.
Right, so where is it? Where's the venue?
It's at Corbin's Wine.
Okay,
yeah,
Corbin's
yeah.
Wine Estate.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I thought that you were initiated that and Mind and Body was sort of partnering with you.
No.
So, sorry, what makes you say that?
I think I've thrown you.
You have?
I think I've thrown you to, because I think that this is something that's really important, that people like myself, these feelings and thoughts don't go away. They don't come easily either as well, like when you actually get to a place where you're not wanting to live. It's not something necessarily that happens overnight. For some people, it's about feeling overwhelmed and just not, and wanting help, and then having the help will help them. But for other people, I think that there is a life is really tough, and it's not easy to live, and you have to live day by day. And I think people that go through this 12-step program with addiction stuff and that, they talk about the fact that they've got to get down to living day by day. And I know that I have been in this place before, and I've come through it and not been in this place. This time has been very hard. It's not shifting easily. But I am here, and what my sister did and what my family is doing to support me is making a difference.
So if they were listening to you right now, how do you think they would be responding to what you've just said?
I'm not sure. I don't think they'd be surprised. I think they know that they've made a difference. And you know, my family's all rallied around them. My mother's got my cats and looking after them, and my dad, I'm living with my dad, and my sister's been so amazing and stuff. So they've all played a part, and I don't think it's been easy on them, especially because it's been longer term.
But I think it comes back to that problem shared thing as well. When you've got somebody else supporting you, you don't feel, you know, it's like being in the desert on your own. If you've got a group of you, at least there's that motivation to keep going. There's someone there to help pull you along.
Yeah, but I'm quite interesting in your response that, you know, Sheldon, that you know, it's not a happily ever after necessarily.
I can appreciate that, but I suppose I am quite thrown by the fact that I understand you've stated that you're still not through this.
Yeah.
And I guess I'd like to ask you how safe you feel right at the moment.
Well, I feel safe enough, and over the last year, I think that as my mood's lifted a wee bit, but there's times when I'm still feeling incredibly unsafe, and I know that there are a lot of other people out there like me that have that on and off, and that you have to learn to live with that. That's what you have to do. You have to learn to live with feeling suicidal.
How do you counter that, though? I mean, things like gratitude, I mean, happiness. We talked to, I read something about happiness, and you've been involved in a happiness project.
Yeah, well, that was actually one of the reasons I did that, is because I wanted to figure, like, if I'm going to live, what do I need? What would make life worth living? Like, years ago, I started asking people, why do you want to live? You know, because I had this lack of joy and this lack of reason for living, and I wanted to know what made life worth living for some people. And so that's why I actually went and that's why I started the Happiness Project quite a number of years ago. And the period of time that we did that, which was like a 3-month period, I really felt joy, and I really felt there was something quite special about what we did in that project. And then I spent the next year figuring out what the hell just happened there. And the documentary that we made called Crazy Happy, which is available to free to watch on YouTube, it's done by Piece of Pie Productions, and that sort of really is a documentary on us looking and reflecting out, like, what the hell happened here, because it was had such a profound effect on quite a few of us. And
and your creativity. I mean, when you came in to the studio 6 weeks ago, you bought some beautiful rocks that you'd painted on, and you'd put gold extensions on, I don't know, extensions, not quite the correct word, and I was able to give one of those to Declan, and I showed it to a number of people. Yeah, so, you know, and you've got a smile on your face as well, you know, and it's lovely to see that, thinking about those things.
Yeah, because I think there's a mistake to think that feeling suicidal is all misery and doom and gloom. You know, like, to me, my suicidality has been about disconnection. Like, I don't have much of an ability to feel connected to people. And when things start going wrong, the people that I am connected to, I start pulling away from. And when you have a real disconnection, that it makes it very easy to leave. And I think maybe what happened with my family was they forced that connection back on me. You know, that they reached out and made me become back into their presence.
Well, I can only urge you to try and remain connected, because I think connection and community are such important assets and values and resources. And I hope that that mind and body art therapy initiative, the venue of that is the Corbin's Estate, which is up on the way to Helensville. So we'll try and get some more detail from Mind and Body about that. Declan has promised an Aretha Franklin track. I'm afraid we're running out of time
for
that.
Yeah, I'll save her for next week.
And I think we will save it for next week. I just want to say that Drive Direction has a event on tomorrow at 28B Lambie Drive. I think I've got that right. It starts at 9:45, finishing with lunch at 1 p.m. It's a hui. You can email Drive Direction at hello@drivedirection.org.nz. So bring yourselves, your peers, your whānau, your team. Speakers will include Magdal Hammond, who is the National Manager Lived Experience from Emerge Aotearoa, David Cuttenfree, who is the Drive Manager, and also David Ringrose on behalf of Family Success Matters. So that's tomorrow at 9:45. We've also clarified the date of the AGM of Hearing Voices Network Aotearoa. It's definitely on Saturday the 25th, this Saturday, from 1 p.m. to 4:15. It's part of a presentation which is entitled Exploring Experiences of Other Realities with guest speaker Egan Bidwa, who used to work with Like Minds. So that's down in Wellington. I think it's free entry. Let's see here. It's the Home of Compassion Conference Centre at 2 Rhine Street, which is off Murray Street in Island Bay, Wellington. So that must be Island Bay, I think, is on the other side of the harbour. So anyway, you can get in touch with Hearing Voices at hearingvoices.org.nz. How are we doing, Declan?
We've got a couple of minutes. I've got a couple here if you want me to throw them on.
Okay, let's throw those
on. Okay, Recovery College, Exploring Wairua, 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Wednesday the 29th of August. It's where it says at Drive, Consumer Direction, 28C Lambie Drive in Manukau. It's free to go to. Spaces are limited, so if you want to go to that, register at hello@drive, as in drive your car, drivedirection.org.nz. Where is it? Wednesday, 29th, 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m.
I think it's 9:30 to 12:30, according to the information I have here.
I've got another one too.
Yeah, Wednesday the 29th.
Can I put this other one in
you
as
can
well?
Do.
Yeah, because it's due for the 30th of August. This one is, this is the one we're going to get KFC if they don't give us lunch. The August Network meeting on the 30th of August, I think it's a Thursday, not too sure, 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. It's at the Kauai Lounge, Windsor Park, 550 East Coast Road, Morangi Bay, and you need to RSVP to our voice, as in OURVOICE, at equip.net.nz, or you can phone 477-0338. And you've got 30 seconds, you can play.
Well, that's definitely a Thursday, and I hope to get along to that. And, of course, EQIP is the organisation that operates at the Baptist Centre on the North Shore, I think at Browns Bay. And they are the ones that have that wonderful respite centre, Coromico. So if you wanted to get in touch with EQIP, I'm sure they would give you detail and what availability there is. But our guest, Denise, mentioned Coromico and her experience there, and I can say it's certainly the best and most modern contemporary mental health respite centre I've ever seen. Your feeling about that, Denise?
Yeah, it certainly does feel that. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful place to be.
Yeah, no, it's quite outstanding. It really
is. It's like being in a motel.
Exactly, yes. How it's funded, I'm unsure, but perhaps our reference to Coromico may encourage the CEO of EQIP to come on the show and tell us how it was developed and talk about some of the wonderful facilities there. So that's, yes, that's pretty much take it from us. We've got a few seconds, have we?
No, that's about it. I just wanted to throw something in there and